The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So the last of the seven stages of purification has the title Purification Through Knowledge and Vision. And how it differs from the previous two purifications through knowledge and vision, there's nothing after knowledge and vision, meaning that it doesn't specify what understanding or what purification or what insight a person has that leads to purification. It just says purification through knowledge and vision. And I like this very much, that there's nothing specified. That's something that you're supposed to see or supposed to understand. There's no object to the knowing and seeing that's mentioned in the title. And maybe that's out of, I'd like to believe that it's out of choice, because maybe at this point it's not about seeing something, attaining something, knowing something. But maybe in a certain way it's the absence of something. So I hope that some of the examples I'm going to give maybe kind of begin pointing to this. And I want to start by reading a story from a monastery within. And the title of the story is A Day Without Self. One evening, the abbess declared that the next day every monk and nun was prohibited from using the words I, me, mine, and myself, unless it was required for answering a direct question from someone else. The next morning was chaotic. Feeling as if they were learning to walk all over again, the monastics kept tripping over their words and stumbling in all their interpersonal interactions. By the afternoon, some were humbled, confused, or dismayed to learn how frequently their impulses to speak, as well as their thinking, were self-referential. By the evening, the predominant atmosphere in the monastery was one of relief, as the monks and nuns realized that they had survived an entire day without initiating any self-focused discussion. And as they laid themselves down to sleep, each person was amazed at how clear and at ease their mind had become. Amazed at how clear and at ease their mind had become. It's a nice way to go to sleep at night. And that clarity and the ease that the monastics felt at the end of this challenging day of not speaking with me, myself, and mine words was a result from the absence of doing something. Not seeing something, doing something, but rather with the absence of those, that kind of self-referential thinking and speaking, something could shift. Maybe some stress in the mind, agitation in the mind, some activity of the mind could be put to rest, to relax. And the ease and the clarity came from an absence, not from attaining something or seeing something or knowing something, but rather the absence of something. So it's a very powerful absence, the absence of not thinking in self-referential ways. Some people will go to great extents to distract themselves so it can stop the churning and the kind of the grinding in their minds around themselves, me, myself, and mine. If you find yourself in a long, deep, dark cave in the mountains, and it's no light, no flashlight, and you have to find your way out, and you kind of know that there are ledges and big chasms in this cave, so if you do a misstep, that you'll fall. And you know you have to follow the cave walls, floor in some direction, but so you go and you feel and touch with your hands and your feet, maybe on your knees, and every contact, sense contact you have of touch is so important to get the information you need in the dark to know where you are and to, you know, safe to go, take the next step, the next step forward. And so there's a, you know, maybe it's relatively safe, but there is big risk involved. And so the mind is constantly involved in feeling, touching, scenting, maybe hearing, maybe smelling, maybe whatever senses you can use in the dark to try to find your way, maybe sniffing for the fresh air, where that is coming from. And it might be fairly intense work after hours of doing that, and you know you can't stop, you have to keep going. And then after a long time, the person finally comes out suddenly, like their head pops out into the sunlight, out of the cave, into this beautiful kind of hillside vista view into safety. And the first experience of stepping in out of the cave is not looking at, wow, look, there's poppies and pine trees, and look at those clouds, I wonder what kind of clouds those are. You know, not looking at anything in particular, but the first experience is relief or release from no longer having to constantly be feeling moment by moment the way you go. Initially, kind of coming into the opening is this kind of release and letting go of the effort to constantly find our way and feel our way and find to go forward. But just it's, and you know, for a moment, there's nothing actually seen, looked at in any kind of, you know, studied way. Just it's more like the absence of needing to feel and sense that is such, wow, release. This is finally, isn't that nice? Or then there's, near my house, there's a small lake that we can swim in and kind of murky waters. And in the middle of the lake, there's a float. And on the float, there's a water slide. And the water slide is kind of tall, and the ladder going up is kind of steep. And it's on this float, and so it's, you know, it's pretty stable, but it rocks a little bit, especially when the kids are jumping off it and stuff. So you can swim out to that float and climb up, and you can climb up the rungs of this ladder, steps, and you know, I did it, and it wasn't the kind of thing I just wanted to rush up. I felt like I had to take each step, put my squarely, fully connect to each step, each rung, really be firm there and hold the handrails on the side. Before I took the next step, felt myself stable there and then pushed up and moved up. And, you know, it was kind of far down. You know, it's like this was, you know, I felt like I need to be really know what I'm doing here, really connected and hold on and be firmly established in each of these rungs. And then finally I came up, you come up to the top of the slide and you put your legs over and you're sitting there with a great view of gray-brown lake and below. And it's like pretty peaceful up there. Great view, pretty awesome. And you know, it's peaceful, quiet, nothing to do, no one to become, just there. And you don't really want to walk down the rungs. You know, it's kind of, and maybe there's kids behind you. So at some point you have to let go. And so at some point, you know, but it's long down. You know, uh-oh. So at some point you let go. And you let go of the side and whoosh, and that letting go, there's like gliding and sliding and then down to the bottom and big splash back in the water where you began. So like these seven stages of purification are like the rungs on the ladder. And each one you want to kind of stabilize in and be there at and really feel it and be, you know, you don't want to rush ahead too quickly. You don't want to fall off and hit the kid below you. Just step by step. And then you get to the top. And at the top, you get to sit there peacefully. Nothing to do, nothing to attain, nowhere to go. And the top of the seven stages of purification, at least the top of the sixth one, is equanimity. Equanimity towards all conditions, all formations. And it means that the mind is balanced, peaceful, non-reactive, at ease, not trying to make anything, do anything, attain anything, prove anything, understand anything. The mind has nothing it has to do except just sit in this clarity, this peacefulness, this openness, just there. And then at some point, something lets go. Something releases there. And it's not something we can do. And then we slide down the slide. We let go. And it's just, it's so wonderful to let go. And this idea of letting go, the deliciousness of it, the wonderfulness, the release of it, the relief of it, in a sense, has no object. There's nothing we're holding on to anymore. Climbing up, we're holding on to something, the sides of the ladder. On the top, you're kind of holding on to the sides of the top of the slide. But then we have to let go of everything. And that letting go is a feeling of freedom. And then letting go, there's also, when you get to the bottom, there's a moment of flying, you know, you get to the bottom and bounce off. And this feeling of freedom and flying for a moment. There's nothing, no holding on. It's the letting go. It's a deep kind of letting go and sliding into the letting go, or sliding with the letting go. So with after the sixth stage of purification with this balanced equanimity, then at some point, but only at the point where the mind is at ease, peaceful, non-reactive, unself-conscious, no self-referencing going on, no trying to attain anything, do anything, understand anything, make anything, get anywhere, but this clarity, openness, complete presence in this moment, simplicity of mind, perhaps no thoughts, just here. At some point, something might let go. And that letting go is a release. That letting go feels so good. It feels like freedom, because it's freedom from all the things that we were holding on to, all the things we were concerned with, all the things that we were suffering with, all the ways in which we were kind of going through the cave, feeling every possible and, you know, touch, and because we had to kind of, everything was so consequential. But we just complete letting go. And have an experience of letting go, where release and letting go, where there's absolutely no suffering. There's nothing there. It's kind of an absence. But it's an absence that is maybe the most meaningful absence a person can have. It's the absence of knowing the freedom of suffering, freedom from any kind of contraction or constriction or closeness. And if you kind of get a kind of, you can't quite touch or see that absence, but you can. But it is not. It doesn't not exist either. It's like really wonderful. But you can't touch it. You can't hold on to it. You can't do anything with it. It's kind of like after keeping your hands in a fist for a long, long time. After a lot of hard work, you're finally able to open your fist into an open hand, and it feels so good. And it's so good to have that open hand that you really want to have that all the time. You want to keep it, so you clutch it. And then it takes you a few more years to figure out how you can open that fist. You can't grab the fist and still have the fist. So there's nothing to grab there. It's actually the absence of grabbing, the absence of holding or clinging. And to know that that's possible for the mind to let go or release such a profound way shows knowledge and vision of possibility of freedom. It's knowledge and vision of an absence, but an absence is not a thing, so it just has knowledge and vision. And the so the sixth stage of purification brings us this balance place, equanimous place where there's no self-referencing, no self-concern, no making, doing, just being, just there. And I liken it a little bit to sometimes out in the mountains you go hiking, you know. Many places, people will gather like riversides. There's the rocks there, the stones, and build little cairns, fill them up kind of. And sometimes people are quite creative in how they balance them and to get them carefully balanced on each other, and you get them, you know, three or four or five or six on top of each other. And it's kind of a fun game to play to see how many you can get balanced and how creatively the stones can stand on top of each other. And as you get, you know, the fifth, sixth stone balancing on the ones underneath, it's pretty tentative how it's going to, you know, whether it's going to stay or not. It's going to, you know, slightest little off balance, whole thing's going to topple. And so there's a lot, if you're the builder, you have a lot of focus, attention, to like, you put that seventh, last stone on top, and you're kind of so attentive, so careful, kind of just barely putting it there and barely kind of releasing it and feeling how it is, and I have to move to the left, to the right, this way, you know, and then you wonder, can I leave it? It looks like it. Can I? And you kind of take your hands back and you step back, and it stays balanced. And when you realize it's balanced, the tension in the mind lets go. It's a release. And it feels so good. Wow. So we come to this balance point, and in that balance point, this poise of equanimity, there can be certain insights, certain understandings. Yes. And we can let go. And there are three primary insights that's talked about, and they're the three characteristics. Which is kind of nice because these are meant to be understood as experiences which are universal, that characterize everything that we experience. So they're available. But different people will single out different ones of them. So some people, for whatever reason, in that poised place, what gets revealed is a whole other new way of seeing impermanence. And in that, seeing that impermanence and seeing how things change and shift, then there's a realizing there's no signifier there. There's no words, there's no label to what's there. And so the tendency to reach for the label, the sign, the thing, is released. We step back. No. The mind steps back. Oh, I don't have to do that. Can't do it. And then, you know, oh, there's a release of always going on, always the mind orienting itself through the words, the concepts, the labels that we have about things, like I talked about the bell. Or a person has an insight into dukkha, into suffering, stress, unsatisfactoriness. Somehow there's something, even things that are pleasant, there's some kind of subtle tension or stress inherent in everything. Or not in everything, but in every way which we experience things. And to really sense and feel that as it arises, for some people, that's where they give up any tendency to want anything. How could you want any of this in this deep state? You know, so the mind gives up its strong drive to want. And in that release of the wanting, you could hear slide, go down the slide. Let go. Or there's there arises the insight into not self. And so you see that all the experience, everything that you're seeing and being with, none of it qualifies as a self. It doesn't make sense to take it as a self. And then the drive to find a self or to be a self in the midst of self gets released. Because it's so clear, it doesn't make sense. And why some people have, they're called doors, why some people use one door rather than the other, I don't know. Maybe because the people who have strong drive to selfhood, maybe they're more inclined to see than not self, and that's what helps the release. People have strong desire. They see that, you know, how unsatisfactory things are. They can release that desire. People have a strong tendency to be in words and concepts and understanding of their life. Can let go of the concepts. This is the impermanence door. And so it's kind of a remarkable process because it's a not-self process. It's not something you can make happen. But we bring ourselves to this place of equanimity. And if we practice there and we come to it repeatedly in the practice and come there and it's not, when the Dharma is ready, the door is open so we can emerge out of the cave. But, you know, when the Dharma is ready. So, you can't, for all your wishing, it's not going to help. So, and then the interesting thing is that one of the very important values of this stage of equanimity is to really get a visceral, personal, direct understanding of how deeply equanimous it's possible to be. And kind of the, maybe for the mind to get a sense of this is a possibility, no self-referencing, no wanting, no aversion, just deep equanimity. And to kind of get, and to get into it, when there's equanimity is strong and established there, even though it's quite special state compared to ordinary states of mind, it's not special. Because as soon as it's special, the mind's too busy looking at it special. It becomes just ordinary. And this idea of the ordinariness of all this, and then kind of relaxing around the specialness, relaxing around attainments, relaxing about anything, and then the release that can happen might not happen when we're in the state of equanimity. Because some people go up to there and they're not quite equanimous because they're sitting there kind of not just poised like in a balanced way, but poised for something to happen. They're like, wait, this is it. You know, oh, and I'm just around the corner. I'll let go. But it doesn't have to happen there. It might happen at one of the other earlier stages of purification, because the person's gotten used to the ordinariness of this, the simplicity of it, that being present without making a big deal of it, without trying to make it special or trying to make it mine or self-referencing, and so after a while that becomes a little bit more. We fall into these kinds of states of simplicity in a deeper and deeper way. And these deeper states of simplicity, when we're not trying to make something happen and do something, when the mind is well conditioned, well supported by practice, at some point something lets go, gives way. And it's the giving away, the letting go, that release. That is so, you know, that's the freedom. But then we go down the slide, and guess where you end up? Back in the water. You'd managed to get yourself out of the water onto the raft, and then on the raft, the Dharma is the raft. There's a story about the Dharma being the raft. So up on the raft, up the ladder, to his great heights. And you don't stay there. When the cost of freedom, the cost of letting go, splash. You're right back where you started. But hopefully you're back in a different way. Now you know something. You know about freedom. You know what's possible. You know how fully it's possible to let go and be released. And perhaps you understand, in a way you could never have been done before, how that the whole idea of self is kind of a construct. It's a construct. I don't want to say it's an illusion, but it's something that has no inherent existence of its own, but rather it's a confluence of many different forces and activities and thoughts and identifications that come together. And it has its role, has its place, but you're less likely to ever take it as being solid and fixed, like this is really real. It's kind of like, I don't know if it's almost real, or, you know, are the actors on your TV real when you see them on TV? I mean, they're kind of real, but they're not people there, just these electrons kind of showing around. So there's kind of this freedom, this kind of emptiness, this release from holding on to this center of self. And all the ways in which we function in the world successfully can still operate. So it's not so, it doesn't have to be frightening. It's just that there isn't the wind drag of self. There isn't the kind of, you don't get tripped up around this thing that you're so solid needs to be defended and created and held on to and be referred to all the time. Someone gives you some years ago, wasn't there the pet rock? Someone gives you a pet rock and tells you, you know, this is very important, this is a pet rock, you have to take good care of it, tend it carefully, love it, you know, it needs to be petted a lot. And so you go, okay, see, it's a pet, okay, and so you don't, you know, it's okay, so you pet it and you put it in safe places and keep it warm and you do all this stuff with a rock. You know, because it's a pet. And then a friend comes over and looks at you and says, do you know that's just a rock? Oh! Well, it's still special. My friend gave it to me, but I guess I don't have to keep it alive and keep it happy anymore. We've been petting it, and it's just a rock, you know. So like this, you know, we've been kind of tending ourselves for decades, years, you know, this rock we have, this self, petting it and keeping it warm and putting clothes on it. And then you've kind of finally come out of the cave and you said, wait a minute, there was no rock in there. There's no thing in there that's the self. Release. So I'll end with another story. And it's a little bit adopted from an analogy given in the book called The Path of Purification. So you're walking in some great fields and a beautiful day. And then you find on the edge of the path, there's a little bird that's laying there, clearly alive, but kind of just laying there. And you kind of look and you think, oh, it looks like it's just stunned. But you know what's going on with it? But there's a hawk flying around above. Uh-oh, if I leave, that hawk is eyeing that bird. Maybe I should protect this bird. So you pick up little bird in your hand and hold it so it's safe from the hawk and other critters. And you hold it, and it's very tender. You hold it tenderly and lovingly. At first, it's kind of nervous and a little anxious about being held that way. It flutters around inside your hands. But you hold it gently, but just firm enough so it can't get hurt or can't fly away. And after a while, it relaxes. And relaxes, and after a while it feels kind of safe being there, and maybe realizes it's safe from the hawk and that you're not going to hurt it. And then slowly it kind of, it's been stunned, maybe it ran into a window or something, and who knows, but maybe the hawk kind of knocked it down out of the sky. So it got a little hurt, or mostly stunned, and so slowly it kind of gets revived. And, you know, you can see it's getting revived and it's not so dull anymore. Getting good color again, bird color, I don't know what. And then at some point you feel like maybe it's ready to fly again. So you open your hand and hold it out on your palm of your open hand. And the bird stands there, doesn't fly. So you're watching and you're very attentive, you know, you're really concerned about this bird and you want it to fly, and you want people to fly well so the hawk doesn't get it. And so you're kind of like really attentive and caring. And you know, you don't want the bird to fall off your hand and hurt itself. So you're really there. And then, you know, you don't, the bird's content to be there for a long time. You know, it's there, okay. Bird's there. And suddenly, the bird flies off. And there's kind of a moment of relief. But the hawk. And then the bird comes back and lands on your hand. Oh. And then suddenly, unexpectedly, it flies off again. And then it comes back. So you stand there, attentive, careful, available, caring. And then a third time, it flies off. And this time it flies off fast and up and zooms off into the horizon, safe, healthy, but good. And at that point, release for you. The concern you had for the bird, the caring, the wanting to care for it, no longer needed. And there's a kind of freedom in the mind. So this is, in this, in other ways, an analogy is taught in the Path of Purification. It's the idea that the mind can begin this process of becoming free, but sometimes it takes a while before it really lets go fully. It can do it kind of partially and it comes back until finally it releases completely and then the mind is, and it's complete release, letting go. And I believe that some people, hearing that this is kind of the goal of practice, can feel like this is not interesting. This is not where neither valuable. They can't relate to it because, you know, the absence of, why should I be concerned with an absence of something? Just release. That seems like just self-centered or something. Just, you know, freedom from suffering. I have people to see and things to do, and relationships are important for me, and feeling a connection to the world is important for me, and so all these things that people feel are very important. And so sometimes people have ideas of other things as being more important than release. Because the idea of release doesn't seem quite like, it's not as attractive, or it's not as compelling, or it doesn't, you know, it's just... So some people then are reluctant to go there, or to value it. And then what's often then said is that, but all the other things, you can do them much better if you're free. There's greater compassion, there's more greater wisdom, there's less, you know, attachments that get in the way. And so we can live our life more fully, the things that are important. But I think that when you have this experience of this profound release, this full release, and know what the absence of suffering is like, that it's the most wonderful peace and happiness that a person can experience. And that the idea that it's possible for people not to suffer is such a profound thing when there's a world, there's so much suffering in the world. And to, in our human connectedness, in our human, you know, mirror neurons, or our human sense of empathy or connectedness, what do we want most for other people to experience? We want them to be free of suffering. And then they can go about and live their lives in whatever way they think is important. But wouldn't it be nice if our families and friends and our communities knew this depth of freedom from clinging, from craving? Especially when so many of the problems that exist in our world stem from the clinging and craving people have. And that source of the problem is no longer there in people. That's a phenomenal thing. And the hope is that some people know that depth. Some people know that possibility of freedom. It's a gift. It gives, I think, it points to hope. It points to something that's profoundly true in each of us. And I think our society needs some people who have touched this depth, touched this possibility. Because if no one has done it, if no one knows it, then the only other option is to learn how to cling, crave, and suffer better. And I don't know if that's a good option. You know, there is an option, there is a possibility of letting go, of release. And the path to that is to see clearly, knowledge and vision. And it's not about attainments, it's not about states. It's about the kind of seeing, the ability to be present and see clearly in the moment that leads to something beyond itself, the freedom from clinging.